invite the rest of you to return to your seats and grab your Bibles and turn to one of the hardest passages in the entire Bible, Daniel chapter 7. I drew the short straw for this sermon. It's crazy that we have, that class got canceled and some extra kids are in the service that wouldn't otherwise be, because the cookies are very much on the top shelves today, unfortunately, just by nature of the passage that we're in. So I'm going to do my best. And Rob handed Chantel a little, a page that it says it's for the kids to follow along with. So what's the sermon about? And Chantel's like, oh, this is a graphic organizer. This is going to be helpful for following along. Probably not, but good luck. We shall see. The image that you have in front of you is a painting by a Belgian artist by the name of René Magritte. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Those of you, where's Annika? Who's in French immersion right now? Okay, how do you pronounce this? M-A-G-R-I-T-T-E. Magritte? You don't know, okay. I'm told it's French, and then I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. So the painting there is actually known as, it's called The Son of Man. That's the title of the painting. It's supposedly a self-portrait of the artist. And this is René's description of his painting, at least a little bit of sort of the message that he's getting at with it. He's speaking first about the apple, and he says, the apple, at least, it hides the face partly well, so that you have the apparent face, the apple itself, hiding the visible but hidden, the face of the person. It's something that happens constantly. Everything we see hides another thing. We always want to see what is hidden by what we see. There is an interest in that which is hidden and what the visible does not show us. This interest can take the form of a quite intense feeling, a sort of conflict, one might say, between the visible and that which is hidden, the visible and the present. It's a quote from Wikipedia. In some ways, that really does overlap with where we are today in terms of we're going into Daniel chapter 7, which is the genre of Daniel chapter 7 is apocalyptic. It's a strange genre of images and strange things happening. So these are some of the images that we are going to encounter. And I think there's some overlap between this artist's description of his painting and what we're going to encounter in apocalyptic literature. Apocalyptic literature, first of all, is elusive. But it's artistic at the same time, and it refers to historical events, but it uses images, and so those historical events kind of hide behind the picture, in a sense. The picture does refer to them, but they're much more elusive. They're hidden behind it. So the picture draws us in a sense, and it makes us want to ask, what's behind this? What's behind what I see in front of me in this text? So that's where we're going to be today. It's going to be a challenge, and I apologize. Well, not really, because God wrote this, but I'm just doing my best with what he's written. When N.T. Wright was a student if he was teaching at Oxford at the time, but he was in a seminar on the topic of the Son of Man, Daniel chapter 7, and it gets picked up in the Gospels, the Son of Man. He was walking into the seminar on the Son of Man, and one of his colleagues beside him, this is Oxford, right? One of his colleagues mutters, son of man, that way lies madness. This is a challenging text. It's vexing. So we're going to do our best, but that way lies a whole lot of challenge. All right. Now, what is apocalyptic literature? I want to break it down for us, partly because, not just because it refers, that's what Daniel chapter 7 is, it's apocalyptic literature, but also because Rob would really like us to preach on Revelation in the new year. I'm throwing you under the bus, buddy, because this was your idea. But Revelation is apocalyptic literature, and so what we talk about now, we'll probably just duplicate this slide in another couple of months when we go back to Revelation, because this does, there's a lot of overlap, and Revelation is highly dependent on Daniel chapter 7. As well as other parts of Daniel. So apocalyptic literature, first of all, it uses symbolic images. Symbolism is just all over the place. And so speaking of Revelation, it's hilarious to me that some people want to read Revelation as though the numbers, for example, in Revelation are literalistic. So there is a 1,000-year reign of Christ, and that means 365,000 days, right? 1,000-year reign of Christ. But then it's also described like within a page or two, and there are going to be 120,000 people in front of the throne. That's metaphorical. There has to be more than 120,000 people in heaven, right? If you pick and choose, what? Symbolic, okay? They're not, you don't read these things as literalistic, like too literalistically, okay? That this refers to something else. So it's going to be using metaphor. Expect this. Secondly, it uses its symbols using insider language. Images. So for example, if you see a cartoon, I've shared this example before. If you see a cartoon with a beaver facing off on a frozen pond against an eagle, you guys could decipher that image, couldn't you? A beaver faces off against an eagle on a frozen pond. What's this about? Pardon me? Canada versus U.S., playing a hockey game, right? You guys can put that together because you are intelligent, thoughtful Canadians, but you've been brought up in a certain context where these images mean something to you. You're not thinking that it's actually something that happened last week out on a local pond, right? At least not in terms of this animal versus that animal, right? Same type of thing is happening here when we get into this type of literature. These images are insider language. They come from their culture. And we have this all of the time, all of the time. Teachers here are going to completely understand this. When you talk about insider language, teachers will say, well, an LAT created an IEP for a kid coded as cognitive. And how many of you teachers and EAs just understood what I said? Right. Yeah. The rest of you are like, what on earth is that? Okay, this is just, we have insider subculture language. If you have a teenager and your teenage son tells you that he and Sally are wheeling, I have one person laughing. If your teenage son tells you that he and Sally are wheeling, you're thinking he and Sally are like going to be riding a bicycle built for two, or they're working at a deal or something like that, and actually wheeling is some sort of like strange teenage slang for we're sort of in this pre-dating stage or something. But it's insider language. It comes from a particular subculture, right? Same thing is happening over there. Same thing is happening here in our text. They're using insider language. So the symbols come out of their thought world. So we're about to see some beasts come out of the sea. You got to understand what the sea means to these people. They're not thinking a local body of water. The sea, in their thinking, is a source of chaos and fear and anti-creation and evil. It's not a local body of water. It's not talking about the Mediterranean. So, symbolistic language, insider language, focus on the big picture, not the details. You're going to see a beast that's going to have teeth and claws. Don't look for the significance between teeth and claws, as though, you know, claws grow and teeth fall out, something like that. No. No, look at big picture, first of all. What's this a symbol of? Well, it's something ferocious. It's something dangerous. But don't try to distinguish one from the other. Some of these details are just here to paint a much broader picture of something scary. Don't focus on details unless the author does. One particular author, Trimper Longman, says that apocalyptic is true, but it's not precise. Okay, so don't push details too far unless the author goes into, puts the focus on it. Big picture first. Next, time and chronology, these are fluid. They're very fluid. We're getting images here, but it's hard to then work out a particular chronology. So we're going to see four beasts that are going to appear as part of the image, the scene that's being presented. The beasts represent kings. Well, all of these kings came one after the other. They don't overlap, but in the image they do. Okay, chronology is a little bit more fluid. You're going to see this in Revelation as well, where Revelation is, it's not completely linear. Revelation cycles back and uses different images a number of times. But we're not there yet. It's highly emotive language, emotional. Their feelings matter. I just mentioned the sea is the source of chaos and fear. These beasts that come out of the sea, these mutants, like, they don't live in a world of Ninja Turtles and Godzilla. Okay, these are terrifying creatures. This is an image that just evokes absolute horror to the people who are going to be hearing about it for the first time. Horror and disgust at the perversion that's happened to God's creation. That's what's being evoked to the people who are hearing this for the first time. This is a nightmare of a vision. Now, it ends with hope, but it is a nightmare at the beginning. Lastly, this particular genre of apocalyptic always has historical events in view. Don't look for just sort of timeless truths as though this is just trying to teach us about good versus evil or something like that. No, apocalyptic arises during this particular genre is only used for a brief period of time, just a couple hundred years, and it's always during times of oppression when God's people are being oppressed. They turn to this particular type of genre. But it has space-time events in view. And that's where we've been in the book of Daniel. These people are in the context of exile. They are a conquered and deported people. They've been living in a foreign land where the people who built the Tower of Babel, that's the link there, these people are getting ahead, and God's people are not. God's people have been threatened. Their religion has been threatened. God has been blasphemed. And things aren't getting better. They're getting worse. And now we turn to this particular genre as a result. So with that heady introduction in mind, Daniel 7, verse 1. Please follow along if you have it. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and the visions passed through his mind as he was lying in bed, and he wrote them down the substance of his dream. Daniel said, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle, and I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being, and the mind of a human was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear, and it was raised up on one of its sides, and it had three ribs, or maybe three tusks, in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, 'Get up and eat your fill of flesh.' After that, I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard, and it had on its back four wings like those of a bird. This beast had four heads, and it was given the authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and the three of the first horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a human being and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated. The books were opened. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words that the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority but were allowed to live for a period of time. In my night vision, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit because my friend Ben would have to preach this. And the visions passed through my mind, disturbed me, and I approached one of those standing there and asked, "What on earth is going on?" As you might at this very moment, Daniel too was troubled. he said, the person, the angel said to him, so he told me and gave me this interpretation, the four great beasts are four kings that will rise from the earth, but the holy people of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, ever and ever. Let's stop there. Thankfully, Daniel's got some help with his interpretation because it's a troubling vision. First of all, he's told that these kings, as we've said, are beasts, or the beasts are kings, I should say. The first one does, it is very much described the way that Nebuchadnezzar is described when he has his experience of being driven away from people and having to go live off the land and having a sort of a beastly mind. And for a period of time, sort of has his own little mutation experience. And then his mind is returned to him, and he stands back up on his feet. And so the description very much overlaps. The first one does really look like Nebuchadnezzar. But the other ones, it's harder to map them onto any particular ruler after that. Now, we have four kings, and they represent their kingdoms. But what is most important is, would you go to the next slide? We have a court scene. This is absolutely crucial that you get this in your mind, and it's repeated further on down in the passage as well, that this is a court scene. The Ancient of Days is seated on his throne, and there is a trial taking place. There's a trial taking place here at the moment. And on the one side are the beasts, the four kings and their kingdoms, and on the other side is the Son of Man. And we'll talk more about what the Son of Man is in a minute. The issue that's being decided in court this day, as you read through this passage, is who's going to be in charge on the earth? And the judge, the Ancient of Days, decides against the beasts and in favor of the Son of Man. It's crucial that you see that and that you understand that for the rest of this passage. This is a court, and the judge has issued the verdict. He has decided against the beasts, and he has decided in favor of the Son of Man. The beasts are stripped of their power and authority, and it is given to the Son of Man. That's what happens when the judge issues the verdict. Okay. Now, the Son of Man is first described as an individual in the image. It's just like the kings are, and their kingdoms are described as one particular beast. The Son of Man is described as one individual. And then later on, it says that it is when the angel offers the interpretation of the dream, he says that the kingdom of God, the kingdom goes from the beasts to not the Son of Man, he says the holy ones. In other words, the people of God. So there's sort of this interplay between single figure and the group that that figure represents. Understand? Single figure, king, represents kingdom, people. The angel reflects that in the same way. Son of Man, single figure, represents the holy ones. And that comes out explicitly in verse, 18. The holy people of the Most High receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. So perhaps this is a messianic figure who represents God's people, as all kings do, right? All kings represent their people, and it's the people that essentially exercises his rule through his people. So we shouldn't play those two off against each other too much. That's the short version that the angel gives Daniel. That's the short version of the interpretation the angel gives Daniel. The gist of it is essentially that God is going to decide in favor of his people and against the beastly kingdoms who have been oppressing his people at the time. But Daniel is really troubled by that fourth beast. And we haven't exactly been told why God has decided in favor of his people and against these other nations. So in the next part, can you picture that if Daniel had sort of had his iPhone up there and he had been recording this particular vision, it's sort of like he then hits pause, and you know how you can scroll your finger back across and you're going to sort of rewind? It's like he's going to rewind a little bit, and then he's going to hit play, and as he's doing, he's going to take his little fingers, you know how you can pinch and zoom? He's going to pinch and zoom up, zoom in on that fourth beast. That's what's happening here in the next section of Daniel. We're going back over what was just described, court scene, what's happening with the beasts, but we're going to focus in on the one particular beast, the fourth beast. Okay, that's what's happening. Verse 19. I'm going to read this really quickly because, Then I wanted to know the meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from the others and most terrifying, with iron teeth, bronze claws, the beast that crushed and devoured its victims and trampled what was left. I wanted to know about the 10 horns on its head and the other horn that came up after three of them fell out, the horn that looked more imposing than the others, and it was speaking boastfully. I watched, and this horn was waging war against the holy people and defeating them until the Ancient of Days came and pronounced judgment in favor of the holy people of the Most High. And at that time, when they possessed the kingdom, he gave me this interpretation. So he's speaking to the angel again. The fourth beast is the fourth kingdom that will appear on the earth. It will be different from the other kingdoms, and it will devour the whole earth. It's going to spread out. It's going to trample them. 10 horns are 10 kings that are going to come up out of this kingdom. And then another king will arise, different from the others. He'll subdue the previous ones, speak against the Most High, oppress the holy people, try to change set law, set times and seasons. This has to do with religious ceremonial, Jewish calendar, etc., a religious calendar. He's going to try to change religious things. The holy people will be delivered into the hands of this beast for a time, times, and half a time. Then the court will sit, and his power, the beast's power, will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of the kingdoms under the heaven will be handed over to the holy people. Son of man, the holy people of the Most High, and his kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. This is the end of the matter, and I, Daniel, was deeply troubled. Rightly so, right? My face turned pale, but I kept the matter to myself. Daniel is told that this beast does a few things. First of all, it speaks against God. It oppresses God's people for an indeterminate period of time, a time, times, and half a time. In other words, we don't know. That's not a very accurate description of time, is it? And he attempts to change the religious calendar. In other words, he's starting to, this ruler is starting to impose himself not just on the state, but on religion as well. Now, I am not going to address 10 horns, 3 horns, 1, for the simple reason that it doesn't map easily onto any particular kingdom or ruler that comes after. It doesn't matter if it's Greeks, doesn't matter if it's Romans, doesn't matter if it's someone else. In other words, I'm not convinced that these numbers are referring to specific, like 10 specific kings followed by 3 specific, followed by 1. I'm not entirely sure that that's how that's working. But if you want to delve into that, go nuts. I can point you in that direction. Son of man and numbers, that way lies madness. Go for it if you want. I'm not quite convinced that the numbers are being used as literalistically as we typically think of numbers. So I'm going to leave that aside. In any case, these numbers, I think that these numbers are probably more just being used to paint a picture. We're going to have a whole bunch of kings. We're going to have some transition because of the interplay between them. Kingdoms typically don't always, like rulers don't always get along with one another. It doesn't just pass unproblematically between father to son to grandson, right? But regardless, the language of the way that, the language that this is used to describe how God's people are treated and the way that these dictators act could be applied to any ruler that is against God's people. Arrogant speech, sacrilegious actions, and coercive behavior. Right? That could apply to anyone. Doesn't matter if it's the Greeks or the Romans or more contemporary. And we've seen examples of that in Daniel 1 through 6. But the last beast, kingdom, is judged because of its treatment of God's people and its attitude towards God. Because at a certain point, God is going to decide that enough is enough, that he has had enough, and that his people have had enough, and God's going to intervene. So what does that have to do with us? What does that have to do with us? Now is not forever. I think that's what comes out of this. The time when God's people find that they don't fit very well in the place where they are in, because these rulers don't really reflect God very well, It's not going to last forever. And people in exile need that kind of hope, don't they? It's not going to last forever. It won't always be this bad. And eventually, the God that we serve will intervene. And people who are under the boot of someone oppressing them probably need to hear that. Secondly, forever is forever. And this does really come out in the text where the angel says that when God intervenes, it's going to be final. Forever is going to be forever, and God's people will rule as well. Not just the one king, but God's people will rule. And the beasts won't any longer. In fact, only one beast is killed, and the other three remain, and their lives are prolonged, and perhaps it's going to be, according to the vision, that perhaps God's people will even rule them. That seems to be what's indicated. Thirdly, forever isn't here yet. Daniel turns pale and is troubled, perhaps because he's been waiting for a really long time for God to intervene, and he's just found out that it's not happening quite yet. Perhaps it's because the hope that he's offered isn't coming anytime soon. And exile for him continues. Remember, we talked about exile as the place where God and upward mobility compete, where evil is at home and we are her neighbors, and where God often seems powerless. And for now, God's people need to live in exile. And that's part of the message that I think Daniel gets. And 1 Peter, as we talked about at the beginning of this series, describes God's people, Christians, people following Jesus, as exiles. We are still exiles today as well. We are not home yet. And so that means that we actually need to sit somewhat loosely when it comes to loyalty, even to country itself, because we are exiles who are loyal to a different country and a different home, just like Daniel. Just like Daniel. So even on Remembrance Day, as we honor, as we rightly honor the sacrifice that others have made on our behalf so that we could be here and enjoy this, we still sit loosely when it comes to loyalty to country and to those in charge. So we honor them, but it's a very secondary honor to the one we ultimately honor. So we rightly honor their sacrifices, but at the same time, we don't become nationalistic because we are exiles. Jesus says to his followers, "My kingdom is not of this world." Paul says to the people that he is writing to, your citizenship is in heaven. Both Jesus and Paul were addressing people who were incredibly patriotic, incredibly nationalistic, and incredibly proud of their current citizenship. And Paul says, that is secondary. We are ultimately exiles. Exile continues. Now, I know you have all been waiting and wondering, what does this have to do, what does this passage, the Son of Man passage, have to do with Jesus? It's tough. This is another tough part, because Daniel 7 is tough. So here we go. Jesus applies this passage to himself. He says, "You will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven." Jesus is not in that text speaking about his return or his second coming. I believe in the second coming, and so does Jesus. And he says, Jesus goes up, and the angel appears after the disciples are watching him, and he says, "Why are you still looking up there? The Son will return in the way that you saw him leave. He will return, but for now, go." So the Son of Man is returning in the same way that he left. Absolutely. So don't, when I say what I'm about to say, don't say Ben doesn't believe in the second coming. I absolutely do. But when Jesus quotes Daniel 7, he's not referring to the second coming. Okay, here we go. Jesus, what is Jesus doing? What is the context of Daniel chapter 7? What's the image that we had on the screen? It's a trial scene, isn't it? It's a trial scene. It's a court scene. Jesus is quoting an apocalyptic text. Remember, apocalyptic, symbolic language. So it's using an image to refer to something different. He's quoting that apocalyptic text in a trial in which the beasts are judged and the Son of Man is decided in favor of. In other words, the image of this image of the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven is what happens as that's the result of God deciding in favor of the Son of Man and over against the beasts. So when Jesus quotes that text, what's the context in the Gospels when Jesus uses that? Anyone know? When Jesus quotes that text, where is he? Jesus is also on trial. It's the same context in the Gospels. The Son of Man, once again, there is a trial, and the Son of Man is on the dock. He's in trouble. And Jesus tells his accusers that you are going to see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. In other words, you're going to see the same thing happen to me that happened in Daniel 7, which is that God decides in favor of the Son of Man and against the beasts. Do you follow that? Court scene, the same. Verdict, the same. Jesus is saying that he is going to That what happened in Daniel 7 with the Son of Man is going to happen again here in the Gospels. I am going to be decided. God is going to decide in my favor. Jesus is claiming that God is going to decide in his favor and that the beasts are going to be judged. That God is going to rule in favor of Christ. What is the claim that Christ has been making? That he's king. That's why he's on trial. Claiming to be Messiah is claiming to be king. And he's on trial for that. So in the Gospels, the Son of Man is going to receive the kingdom, just like in Daniel chapter 7. He's claiming kingship. Once again, Daniel 7 is the promise. When Jesus says, you're going to see this happen, you are going to see that my claim to kingship, God is going to rule in favor of. Jesus is claiming to be king. He's on trial because of that claim. And he's quoting Daniel 7 to say that God is going to rule in his favor as he claims to be king. The problem is, we're still waiting for the fulfillment of that vision, aren't we? We are still waiting for that kingdom to come fully. All authority on earth, on heaven and on earth, has been given to the Son, but we are still waiting for the Son to fully implement that here, aren't we? We are still waiting for things to be made right. We're still waiting for that kingdom to come. And in the meantime, what we have are visions of the future. What we have are promises that now, what's happening now in the exile that we are currently in will not last forever. It won't always look like this, friends. What we have is a promise that the Ancient of Days will intervene. And that was a brilliant song choice this morning. We sang, our God saves, there is hope in your name. Morning turns to songs of praise because our God saves. That's Daniel 7. That's Jesus receiving the kingdom. That's the hope that we have, that God will intervene and that what is happening today and in your life will not last. That our hope is that, as Daniel 7 says, the court will sit, the beastly ruler's power will be taken away and completely destroyed, and sovereignty and power and the greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be handed over to the people of the Most High, and his kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all will worship him. Our promise is that forever will be forever. And we can look forward to that. Our promise is that it's going to be worth the wait. So Son of Man, that way lies hope. I'm going to offer you some extended time for reflection, partly for the message and then partly because we are, after this, going to go into a time where we do recognize some of the sacrifices of those who very much followed in the footsteps of the Son of Man. The Son of Man came not only to rule but also to offer his life for the sake of others. So I'm going to offer you some extended time of reflection.